Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the stalled transportation bill in the Senate that the Democrats were supposed to vote on without having time to read it. Joan Claybrook, the President Emeritus of Public Citizen and the former Administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, joins us to discuss this industry-friendly bill that lowers the age of interstate truck drivers to 18 so that trucking companies can recruit cheap labor and cuts the required amount of rest time for drivers. We'll also look into the demonstration by hackers working with Wired magazine who, via the internet, hacked the controls on a Jeep Cherokee driving on the freeway and ran it into a ditch. Then we will speak with Michelle Goldberg, the author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, who is a senior contributing writer to The Nation, where she has an article, Why Planned Parenthood Shouldn't Be on the Defensive. We will discuss the propaganda hit that an anti-abortion front group got from a sting they conducted against Planned Parenthood and how the calls to prosecute the actors posing as fetal tissue procurement officers for a fake biomedical company, Biomax, would backfire, turning these right-to-life zealots into martyrs. Then finally, with a chorus on the right and some on the left claiming that Iran got the better of Obama in the recent P5 plus one deal, we will hear from Nader Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. He argues that Iran effectively capitulated to the demands of the West, and we will discuss how the sanctions have strengthened the grip of the clerics and the Revolutionary Guards over the Iranian people, and that their removal could reverse that trend. And joining us now is Joan Claybrook, who is the President Emeritus of Public Citizen, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization that seeks to protect consumer interests in policymaking. The former administrator at the National Highways Traffic Safety Administration of the United States Department of Transportation from 1977 to 1981. She's currently working on issues including product liability, trade and regulatory policies, and auto and highway safety. Her latest article at USA Today is The Road to Hell is Paved with Congressional Legislation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Claybrook.
Thank you.
And what is the latest on where the Senate bill, it was stalled because the Democrats didn't even have time to read it before Mitch McConnell was pushing for the vote. He was supposed to revisit the vote today. Did it happen?
It's going on right now.
I see.
They just started it around 7:30, our time, which is 4:30 your time, and I don't know the answer, the outcome, what it'll be, whether they'll get the decision to move forward with the bill or not. It takes 60 votes of the Senate to do that in this particular case, and so we'll see.
But according to the New York Times, this is an industry-friendly bill that lowers the age of interstate truck drivers to 18, which means that they can simply recruit cheap labor and cuts the required amount of rest time for drivers. Now, we all recall the recent deadly accident involving the comedian Tracy Morgan, whose a friend died in the accident, and he was very critically injured when a Walmart truck driven by a driver who I believe had not slept for 24 hours, crashed into their limousine. And you've pointed out to Joan Claybrook in your article at USA Today, The Road to Hell is Paved with Congressional Intentions, that large track crashes occur so regularly that some 330 people are being killed each month and nearly 8,000 are suffering excruciating injuries from accidents involving trucks. And if this were happening with airlines, the government would have moved immediately to stop this mayhem.
That's correct. And it's very outrageous that different standards are applied to different forms of transportation. But when there's an airline crash, there are often a lot of very important people on those airline. And Congress really cannot tolerate the pressure that comes from the press coverage of a major airline crash. By comparison, truck crashes occur one by one, community by community, and, you know, maybe there are 1, 4, 6 people killed, nothing really ever happens or changes. And the trucking industry gives so much money to members of Congress and has so much clout and harasses members of Congress all the time, full time, that they have a lot of clout in Congress, and so the pending bill would really do some terrific harm. It's an anti-safety bill, not a pro-safety bill. It's the chair of the committee, the Senate Commerce Committee, is John Thune of South Dakota, and so he reported this bill out despite opposition from every Democrat on that committee. And the kinds of things that it does is, in addition to allowing the teen truckers to drive, which is outrageous, you know, just to mention on that, a number of states do allow teen drivers to drive, that is 18 to 21-year-olds, within the state. That is not going interstate, but just within the state. And all the numbers show that their the deaths and injuries are way higher for in crashes and the number of crashes for teen drivers than for regular adult drivers. And so it's a ridiculous provision. And in addition to that, what it does is it would keep secret the safety scores that trucking and bus companies get from the federal government, because the trucking companies say that they're not accurate enough. And they would have a provision for permanent hours of service exemptions so that certain truckers and companies would be exempt for certain types of products. And they also would give the federal government the authority to determine fault in truck crashes without a complete and thorough investigation. And the last thing I'd mention is that they would open up what's called the freeze on longer combination vehicles that was enacted in 1991 and that limits them in the most of the East Coast, and they're only in the West, mostly West, where they have longer distances and fewer.
Hello? Did we lose you?
I'm here.
Sorry. You about to say fewer and you dropped out.
Oh, fewer. There's less traffic in the West. And so this freeze has been in place since 1991. And what the bill says is that certain highways that allow these longer combination vehicles could be extended, but it doesn't specify how much extended. And so more people on the highway would have to deal with these doubles and triples that are extra long.
Well, specifically, these extra long trucks where they have, instead of have a semi-trailer, they have an extra one behind. So they're double trailers of trucks that are 33 feet longer than the current maximum of 28 feet. So these new combination of trucks would be 84 feet long. And we know that the main problem when trucks get out of control is that the sort of tail wags the dog, because the weight in the back fishtails and causes tremendous mayhem with cars in various lanes around it. But if you double that, then you have even more of a whiplash effect, don't you?
Yes, you do. And also, often the highways are not designed for the length of these trucks when they go on and off the highways, and people are scared to death of them. 85% of the public just hate them and don't want to have anything to do with them. And yet they share the highway, and they can't avoid them. And I always tell people to stay behind them, because if the trucker is sleepy, and so many of these truckers are, and they admit to that, then if they fall asleep, they run over you, and that's a killer. So at least if you're behind them, that's not as likely to happen. But I think that the real issue here on the highway bill is that Senator Barbara Boxer of California is very, very anxious to get a six-year authorization bill enacted into law, and thus she's working with, she's a Democrat, she's working with Republican Mitch McConnell to do this, and I do believe in this bipartisan effort. But in this case, the safety title of the law, of the highway bill, goes backwards. It's less safe. And so it absolutely should not be enacted into law. And Boxer used to serve on the committee that reported it out. And she's now in the catbird seat, because Mitch McConnell really needs her support in order to get the highway bill through. And there's no reason that Senator Boxer could not say to Mitch McConnell, I want this safety title fixed as a condition of supporting the six-year bill. But she hasn't done that. She's tried to whip up support from the infrastructure people, the people who build the highways and these kind of companies. And I think she has a stronger and longer obligation, based on her long history of being pro-safety, to insist that this safety title be corrected and that they not adopt one that has all these deficiencies and it's going to be a killer. It's going to kill people. We're going to have more death and injury on the highway, and that we do not need.
And again, I'm speaking with Joan Claybrook, who's the President Emeritus of Public Citizen, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization that seeks to protect consumer interests in policymaking, the former administrator at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1977 to 1981. She's currently working on issues including product liability, trade and regulatory policies, and auto and highway safety. Her latest article at USA Today is "The Road to Hell is Paved with Congressional Legislation." But even if this bill, if Senator Boxer and Mitch McConnell make the deal and somehow roll the skeptics or those that are opposed to this incredibly industry-friendly and consumer-dangerous bill, the House has already said that they're not interested in passing it.
Well, that's true. They want to pass what's called a clean bill, which just extends the authorization for 5 months. And then they'll consider the whole bill next year. So, but you know, people change their minds, and there can be a lot of pressure on the House. And the House is very much governed by the majority leader, or the Speaker, rather. And if the Speaker has some reason to change his mind and say, okay, let's go for the bill now, we'll take the Senate passed bill, that's it. They have a majority in the House, and there's no way to stop it. So then that leaves only a veto by the president. I don't think he likes vetoing highway bills because there is a need for improving the infrastructure and the repairs and so on. And also, usually, I mean, this is the first time in 50 years I've ever seen a safety title go backwards, a bill that says safety in it going backwards instead of forwards. And it's because of the industry pressure. I don't know how the president would react to that, given all the different politics involved. So, yes, the House doesn't want it now, but they could change their mind.
So where can the counter-lobbying come from then, Joan Claybrook, given the obvious power of the trucking industry? Surely the Teamsters, they don't want their members to die on the road and kill other innocent bystanders and passengers in cars on the freeways?
No, the Teamsters are very much supportive of the safety groups and our attempt to try and get safety improvements as opposed to safety, safety going backwards. So, yes, we do have that. I think that one of the things that happens in complicated legislation like this is that the public gets excluded because it's so complicated and it moves quickly and it's hard for people to catch up. So to me, the most important thing that the public can do is to contact their state, their legislatures in the Congress, in this case, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein in California, and tell them that they do not want the safety to be degraded. They want safety to be improved. And I would mention that Senator Feinstein, as I mentioned in my article in USA Today, is hoping to introduce an amendment that would prevent the adoption of the 33-foot proposal, but it's by FedEx and by UPS, to allow 33-foot trailers as opposed to now 28-foot trailers, so they'd be 10 feet longer for every truck. And right now, states can do that if they want to, but only a few states have. 39 states do not. And so this FedEx proposal would preempt every state and make them allow 33-foot trailers. And Senator Feinstein has an amendment to say that the Department of Transportation needs to study this rather than have this mandated without any consideration of the safety implications. So we're very supportive of Senator Feinstein's efforts, and we thank her a lot for taking this on.
And she's joined by Roger Wicker, the Republican senator from Mississippi, in that effort. But conversely, the bill itself to extend the length of these trucks on the freeway is co-sponsored by Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, Republican, and Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine. So,
well, that's right. Now, what they have done is that they've put this provision for longer trucks on the appropriations bill, as opposed to this highway authorization bill. And it sounds like it's, how do you distinguish between them? Well, one actually, the appropriations bill actually gets the money flowing. The authorization bill sets the numbers and allows the appropriations bill to authorize, to appropriate it. So what Feinstein's amendment would do would be to override what Shelby and Susan Collins have done, Senator Shelby and Susan Collins, and say that nothing can occur, even though it's authorized in the appropriations bill. It cannot occur until there's a study by DOT, and it comes out and says that they wouldn't be less safe. But we know they would be less safe. They definitely would, because these longer trucks are not safe.
Well, I think everybody that has ever driven on the freeway, you know, you're driving along the freeway and, you know, you've got your kids in the back of the car, and about 2 or 3 feet away is this behemoth rattling along at 65, 70 miles an hour within inches of you. And sometimes you get jammed between two of these trucks on different on lanes on either side of you. It's just that without even thinking about an accident, just the sense of vulnerability that you have in cars is extraordinary. I would have thought that there would be, if the public knew about what they're trying to pull off in these bills, they'd be outraged.
Oh, totally. I mean, the public hate them. The polls show 85% of the public hate bigger trucks, and they don't even like the trucks we have on the highway today. And so what some senators are trying to do is to make them longer. And what Senator Feinstein is trying to do is to say, let's evaluate them, and if they're not safer, then let's not do it. And so that's really great. But I think that Barbara Boxer, you know, she's not going to run for re-election. It's the end of her career. And I just hope and pray that she will think about safety and not try and push a bill through regardless of the safety rollbacks that are in this bill. So that's really a critical, critical factor. And it's for both large trucks, by keeping information secret about how they perform and having exemptions from the limitations on longer hours of service, and allowing these 18 to 20-year-olds to drive in interstate commerce. Right now, some states allow them, and the fatality rate is more than twice for those young drivers than for 21-year-old and older. And that's just the fatality rate. Then the crash rate is three times as big. So it's a foolish proposal. It's only in there for the trucking industry so they can hire cheap labor. And we're going to be the sacrificial lambs on the highway as a result.
But I'm surprised that Senator Boxer has tried to do this, because she has a pretty good reputation. And she's done it. And apparently she's got backlash from her Democratic colleagues, who are furious that they're trying to push this bill down their throat without giving them time to read it.
Without giving time to read it and without fixing the safety provisions. Because Senator McConnell, the majority leader in the United States Senate, he needs Barbara Boxer's support to try and get this bill through. That puts her in, as I said, the catbird seat. She has the ability, the power, to say to Senator McConnell, I'm going to help you get this bill through, but we got to fix those safety provisions. And she hasn't done it, and that's very, very disappointing. And, you know, I am very fond of her. I've seen her do just wonderful things in the United States Senate. And so I'm hoping that people will call her and say, you know, we want you to push for safety in this bill. And also, this is the first anti-safety bill in the 50 years that I've worked on this issue that I've ever seen come out of the United States Senate. And so it's not a good sign, and it's something that can be fixed. And I think Barbara Boxer could play a critical role in doing that.
Well, it's not often that you roll back progress, right? I mean, that's
right. You don't, and particularly when people's lives are at stake. I mean, if this were an airline issue, and we had 350 airline crash deaths a month, as we do from trucks, then, or 330, I guess it is, we would, I mean, the Congress would be going crazy. And they would say, what's going on? Why is this happening? How do we fix it? You know, what can we do? And they might even ground some airlines, not let them operate. All hell would break loose. And yet, here we are with the that number of people, 330 people a month, are being killed in truck crashes. And 8,000 are being, you know, injured a month. It's 100,000 a year are being injured every month, excruciating injuries from these crashes. And 96% of the people hurt in truck car crashes are the people in the cars. So, and the public knows and understands that because they're the little guy and these big trucks roll right over them and kill them. So there's every reason to assure truck safety and improve truck safety, not cut it back.
Well, Joan Claybrook, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. I hope everyone will call Senator Boxer. Thank you so much.
Well, we're doing our best. And she is our local senator. So.
I know. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joan Claybrook, who is the president emeritus of Public Citizen, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization that seeks to protect consumer interests in policymaking. The former administrator at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1977 to 1981. She is currently working on issues including product liability, trade and regulatory policies, and auto and highway safety. Her latest article at USA Today is "The Road to Hell is Paved with Congressional Legislation." We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the anti-abortion front group's sting against Planned Parenthood.
Trucking, run together, more or less in line. Just keep trucking on, on, on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michelle Goldberg, who's a journalist and author of the New York Times bestseller, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. A senior contributing writer to The Nation, her latest book just out is The Goddess Pose, The Audacious Life of Indra Devi, the woman who helped bring yoga to the West. And she has an article at The Nation, Why Planned Parenthood Shouldn't Be on the Defensive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Goldberg.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And at a press conference today, the Attorney General Loretta Lynch was asked about this Planned Parenthood sting. And in the question, the reporter said it's clear that federal laws were broken by the people who perpetrated this hoax on Planned Parenthood. She didn't say that she was going to do anything about it, but she just said she was looking into it. So what's your understanding about whether or not these people who pulled off this sting are going to be held accountable? Because so far they appear to have, at least in their own terms, won the propaganda war.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that they will. I actually think it would be politically very stupid for the Attorney General to prosecute them. I mean, there seems to be a number of different rules they've broken. I mean, they've definitely broken tax law because the nonprofit that they registered was fraudulent. But, you know, I kind of think that if the Attorney General or, you know, kind of any political appointee were to go after them, it would just turn them into martyrs instead of, you know, kind of small-time hacks, which is, I think, how they would be better regarded. Although, you know, to their credit, this was, on its own terms, a pretty successful propaganda operation.
Well, they've been successful in the sense that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has pledged to introduce an amendment to pending Senate legislation to immediately strip every dollar of Planned Parenthood funding. Senator Ted Cruz called for defunding Planned Parenthood and for an investigation of Planned Parenthood's activities.
Well, these people have been, I mean, you know, this is nothing new, right? Republicans have been calling for the defunding of Planned Parenthood for quite a long time. In a number of states, they've already done so. I think that what's new here is that these videos, you know, particularly the heavily edited versions of them, they give Republicans in Congress a pretext to hold investigations. And so even, you know, if Planned Parenthood didn't do anything wrong, and I don't believe that they did do anything wrong, you know, it's costly to go through these investigations. You know, they can subpoena people. And, you know, meanwhile, you're also going to have investigations in at least seven states so far. You know, so if nothing else, it's just an incredible diversion of resources.
But in terms of the propaganda then, surely the counter-propaganda is more powerful. It's certainly, of course, it's fact-based, and we live in an age where facts don't necessarily trump faith, but nevertheless, if the public understood...
Well, I actually think the counter-narrative is a little bit difficult, you know, because with both of these, the fact is that, well, I think there's two different things here. One is that when doctors talk among themselves, they tend to talk in callous, in terms that even sound brutal to outsiders, right? So I wrote about, it was recently this book, you know, How Doctors, The Secret Language of Doctors, I think it was called. They talked about, you know, a pretty, a doctor who was known for being, you know, compassionate and empathetic, saying to somebody who's coming off an emergency shift on a pediatric ward, you know, how many babies did you box last night? Meaning how many babies died last night. And it's just doctors talk that way. And so when you hear the kind of fairly blunt, you know, blithe way that both of these women talk about fetuses and fetal parts and prices, I think that for most people it sounds pretty brutal. And it would sound pretty brutal if you listen to, I think, a conversation about the you know, the transport and, you know, kind of trade in organs of corpses or, you know, and anytime you're kind of talking about these sensitive subjects, it's going to make people squirm a little bit. And part of what, that's, you know, part of what the anti-abortion movement has tried to do is just say, like, well, look how ugly this is, as if, you know, and hoping that people's natural, inference will be that if something is ugly, it also must be unethical and immoral, when really a lot of things in medicine that are entirely ethical and are entirely moral are also a little bit hard to look at.
But in terms of a counter-narrative, if the public were to understand that the study of fetal tissue and other tissue will bring about cures eventually, we hope, for hepatitis, congenital heart defects, retinal degeneration, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and...
Well, and let me add one thing to that, and also is absolutely crucial in studying the treatment of fetuses and newborns, you know, for testing things like drug reactions. And so that's the argument that I think hasn't been out there and needs to be out there. You know, I think the argument so far has been the people who made these videos are extremists. It happens to be true, but I don't think it really changes how most people are going to feel about watching them unless they're sort of already convinced. What I think needs to be out there is that, you know, it's not as if these remains are being, you know, the kind of collection and transport of these remains might be something that you don't want to think about, but it's not being done for, you know, for kind of mercenary reasons. It's being done. There's a reason why this is legal. There's a reason why all leading medical centers study these remains. These are abortions that would have happened anyway. And so the question is, do we then allow the results of these abortions to be put towards the greater good? Like you said, it's crucial in kind of investigations into treatments for all of these medicines, crucial into investigations into treatments for babies. You know, this is about keeping people alive.
But it does seem, though, beyond the fact that, you know, one of the stings took place here in California, and there's a state law against taping somebody without their consent. But the idea that these phony actors working for this anti-abortion operation, which, as you mentioned, was given tax-exempt status back in 2013 as a biomedicine charity, although all they've done so far is produce this video. The head of the company set up a fake company called Biomax Procurement Services, but they actually went into very secure sanitary areas. They were really given a lot of access, and it seems to me that that was a major invasion of a very secure biohazard area under false pretenses.
I think that we want to be really, really careful about prosecuting people I think that, you know, any kind of prosecution that we use against this organization for penetrating, you know, places that it's not supposed to be and kind of entering under false pretenses, you have to understand that that's also going to be turned around against whistleblowers, journalists. I think that that's not a good road to go down. I mean, if Planned Parenthood wanted to file a civil suit, that would be one thing, and that would certainly be valid. But at this point, I hope that there's a lot of ways that this group should be combated, I would be very wary about going down that road.
Well, I get what you're saying, because it would certainly, you know, a lot of those 60 Minutes investigations you see with hidden cameras, they would all be out the window too. She'd be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So what then do you think can be done?
Well, again, I mean, what's happening right now is that they are out there acting as if they have kind of caught Planned Parenthood doing something shameful. And I think that rather than kind of saying, well, these aren't credible people, which is true, I think that Planned Parenthood needs to, or if not Planned Parenthood, people who benefit from these tissues, you know, like I said, you know, neonatologists, cancer researchers, Parkinson's researchers, patients advocates, they need to be out there defending this kind of research, because that is sort of what's on trial right now, is the legitimacy of this kind of research. I mean, that's the heart of this critique, is that this is a fundamentally illegitimate thing to be doing.
Well, abortion politics are certainly alive and well, and Scott Walker's introduced them into this Republican presidential race, so...
Well, every single one of them has, right?
Right.
Basically, I think that this debate is parallel to the stem cell debate, right? The stem cell debate is another area in which Republicans have traditionally said, you know, these are the products of abortions, and we shouldn't be using them to develop cures, we shouldn't be experimenting with them. And, you know, kind of rather than, I think that what has swayed public opinion has been, again, researchers and patients advocates talking about the incredible potential and importance of this research. And I think, you know, a similar argument needs to be made here. It's a very similar situation.
Well, there's always been a disparity, I guess, between the zealousness and the energy on the anti-abortion side and those that defend abortion rights. And frankly, you know, look what just happened in Texas, where they've basically reduced the number of facilities down to just about nothing under these various friendly-sounding, women-friendly laws that they put out. So to my mind, there's never been a sense that those that are holding the line or trying to hold the line are necessarily meeting or matching this endless, relentless onslaught.
No, I think that that's true. And I think it's incredibly difficult because, like you said, you know, the American public, you know, is kind of pro-choice with reservations, but there is such a disjunction in the intensity of the anti-abortion side and the pro-choice side. You know, there are people who dedicate every, you know, waking life and breath to making abortion illegal, who vote on that issue and nothing else. And there's certainly people who, you know, devote their lives to defending reproductive rights, but it's just, it's a smaller number. And so, you know, and it's also, it's certainly a smaller number in the Democratic Party, right? The Democratic Party is a pro-choice party, but there are fewer Democratic politicians, but that is why they got into politics, why they get up every day, and they're going to kind of use every ounce of political energy and political capital they do to enact this into law. So, you know, it's a real problem. But the strategy of saying, you know, pointing out that these are extremists, it's been the pro-choice strategy for a long time, and it's just never been particularly effective. You know, it's effective when you sort of let them demonstrate their own extremism, you know, like when you have Todd Akin talking about legitimate rape and you have some of these people, you know, kind of saying terrible things about, you know, menstrual rape victims, women who use birth control, you know, the attacks on feminist slits, then they can sort of hang themselves. But when the attacks on reproductive rights are more subtle, simply saying that the people behind them are extremists. I understand the temptation. They are extremists. But that's never been a particularly effective political strategy.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Michelle Goldberg, let me ask you about your new book, The Goddess Pose. And it seems certainly a departure from your earlier books, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, your new book, of course, being The Goddess Pose, The Audacious Life of Indra Devi, the woman who helped bring yoga to the West. What attracted you to this? I mean, not that it's not an extraordinarily interesting woman, I take
that. Well, I mean, part of it was, you know, well, I guess it was two things. One, you know, I've been practicing yoga since I lived in India in my mid-20s. It was sort of my refuge as I was writing these other two books and as I've been writing about the American right. And, you know, I also, I'm kind of a skeptical journalist, and so I didn't believe a lot of what I was hearing in my classes and wanted to know where yoga really came from. You know, what about this history is true? What about the science is really true? And while I was sort of trying to figure that out, I came across this unbelievable story, you know, and unbelievable, I think, whether you're interested in yoga or not, because this is a woman who was born in 1899. She died in 2002. Her life spanned the 20th century. She kind of shows up in so many of the pivotal events of the 20th century, you know, from the Russian Revolution, Weimar Berlin, the Indian independence movement, Shanghai during the Japanese occupation, Hollywood in the 50s. She's, you know, has sort of a yoga school slash like ashram in Mexico in the 60s. In the 70s, she is the emissary for one of India's biggest cults. She played a small but actually historically crucial role in the overthrow of Manuel Noriega. You know, and so it was this story that for a long time, once I found out about it, I used to tell my agent all the time, you need to get someone to write this book. Someone has to do it. And, you know, in 2008, I had finished my last book. I had, you know, been covering the election, and finally I just decided I'm going to do it. And, you know, I thought I was going to be able to do it a lot more quickly than I did, but it was, you know, it was like an escape for me to have this sort of book. It wasn't an argument. It was just an incredible story that I had to, as best I could, uncover and reconstruct.
Well, we're thankful for the story and thankful for your time joining us here today, Michelle Goldberg.
Oh, thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who's a journalist and author of the New York Times bestseller Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. A senior contributing writer at The Nation, her latest book just out is The Goddess Pose, The Audacious Life of Indra Devi, the woman who helped bring yoga to the West. And she has an article at The Nation, Why Planned Parenthood Shouldn't Be on the Defensive. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting a rebuttal of the notion that Iran got the better of Obama in the P5+1 deal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book is The Syria Dilemma, and he has an article at CNN, Nuclear Deal Could Transform Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thank you.
And there's clearly been a chorus on the right saying that the Iranians got the better of the deal with Obama. You know, people like Donald Trump, who consider themselves deal makers, basically say that the Iranians took Obama to the cleaners. But even other voices that have are actually been sympathetic to the Iranian side. I had spoke with William Beeman recently, Flint Leverett and his wife, also Gareth Porter. They all have argued, as William Beeman did the other day on this program, that Iran basically got the better of the United States. And I kept saying, well, you mean he was basically saying that they pulled off this this feint. You know, they pretended to have a nuclear program, which was bargained away, one that they didn't have and didn't intend to have. So I kept saying, well, why would they put themselves through this crippling sanctions regime based upon that calculus? I'd never understood, and to this day I don't understand the logic of that argument. But why don't you explain your argument?
Sure. Well, I think both of the people that you mentioned, both on the political right and the political left, have, I think, fundamentally misread what has been transpiring in Iran with respect to these nuclear negotiations. You know, yes, Iran has been able to hold on to the right to enrich uranium, and it's averted an outright dismantlement of its nuclear sites. But the progress that Iran has repeatedly trumpeted over the past decade in terms of the advancement and the efficiency and expansion of its nuclear program will, as a result of this agreement in Vienna, it will be radically reversed, replaced by strict restrictions and inspections. And it amounts to, I think, a colossal defeat for Iranian foreign policy. I would argue that this nuclear agreement represents the third major defeat for Iranian foreign policy after the Iranian Revolution, the two previous ones being the consequences of the hostage taking of the U.S. embassy and the hostage taking and the way that played out and the cost that Iran had to pay, both financially and politically. The second major defeat was the Iran-Iraq War. And the last major defeat is the one that we're talking about right now, the question of the nuclear program. And in all of those three cases, you know, Iran sort of made a set of demands. It claimed that it would not give in. It attempted to defy sort of the international community. But at the end, in all three of those cases, it had to make major concessions. With respect to the nuclear program, I mean, there's a lot that we could talk about. One is simply the cost of this program. In Iran, there is no published documents over the actual cost of building a very vast and expansive nuclear program, some of it deep underneath a mountain in multiple sites, hoping to continue to produce research and development and uranium enrichment far beyond what is necessary simply for energy production. And all of that has had to be radically reduced and effectively given up to the demands of the international community because of the economic sanctions and the collapse of the Iranian economy, which is teetering on collapse. And it looks like it won't collapse because finally a negotiated agreement was reached for the gradual lifting of the sanctions. And this was actually admitted just yesterday. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif and Akbar Ali Salehi, the former foreign minister and current head of Iran's nuclear program, were trying to sell the deal in front of Iran's parliament, and they actually admitted that, look, the cost of this program has been so staggering, it was unsustainable, and they sort of hinted, without going into a lot of details, that's one of the reasons why Iran had to eventually settle for an agreement, because the cost was simply too great for the country to bear. And what we also know, if you know, the details have been leaked so far. Some of the details of the negotiations have been leaked, and what we are learning is that in the negotiations in Vienna, the Americans were demanding significant reductions in Iran's nuclear program, preventing all pathways to a nuclear bomb, and the Iranian side was negotiating for symbolism. And what I mean by that is that the Iranian side was saying, look, you know, we are very reluctant to completely dismantle or to tear down an existing nuclear facility. What we want is for that building to still stay up, but we can sort of negotiate the internal components and what takes place within that building. And the reason for that is because they wanted to go back home to their own hardline constituency and say, look, you know, we didn't give in. These facilities are still up and standing. We still have sort of enrichment. But, of course, if you look at sort of what Iran was standing for and what Iran was claiming to represent and the aspirations it had for its nuclear program and what they had to concede, it's like night and day. And this is actually clearly, you know, evident to anyone who follows internal Iranian politics. I mean, the hardline supporters of Iran's nuclear program are openly stating, you know, quote, we gave up the maximum for the minimum. And I'm quoting, you know, Iran's the current head of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, a man by the name of Mohammad Ali Jafari. They're using terms like we gave up our crown jewel for a lollipop. So this claim that somehow Iran sort of got the better of a deal from the West is simply not borne out by the realities that we know, and one just has to listen to the lamentations and the criticisms coming from Iranian hardliners who openly acknowledge that this was a defeat for Iranian foreign policy, and they're still secretly hoping that the supreme leader might sort of change his mind and oppose the deal.
And again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book is The Syria Dilemma, and he has an article at CNN, Nuclear Deal Could Transform Iran. So we don't know what the Iranians have spent over the past 15 years investing in this nuclear program, but it's obviously because of the, as you mentioned, the underground facilities, that multi-billion dollar infrastructure has been created. And it's never made any sense in the context of nuclear power, because quite simply, you know, Germany's giving up nuclear power. The Japanese are certainly rethinking it after Fukushima. There's no way in the world you'll get a new nuclear power plant licensed in the United States. Wall Street has given up on nuclear power, even though there's tremendous lobbying. They are certainly going to build some more in India, but it's not exactly the most attractive proposition, and it's certainly not a very economically viable one. And so, why would you then allow your oil industry to basically, you know, atrophy to the point where it's hardly producing anything that it's capable of producing? At the same time, when that's your main source of foreign exchange, to invest in this sort of nuclear chimera?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It just doesn't make sense if one thinks about it rationally. And I'm not even talking about the cost that the average Iranian has had to bear over the last, you know, 10 years as a result of these economic sanctions, the staggering inflation, unemployment, the damage, you know, on multiple levels. The strategy that Iran was pursuing, I think, really was a strategy born out of the decision by Iran's supreme leader and the ruling elites, fearing that, you know, after the American invasion in 2003, that there might be an attempt to press Iran or to pressure it. And so there was a strategic decision to experiment with nuclear enrichment, to pursue and develop the technology, the know-how, where if ever the regime felt threatened by an external power, they could make a quick switch to a nuclear weapon, declare themselves a nuclear power, and then use that as a sort of a safety net to dissuade any type of aggression from coming to Iran. And that's why, you know, the year 2003, 2002, 2003, really after 9/11, the lead up to the Iraq War is very central. That's when the Iran nuclear program becomes really controversial. It's discovered that they're sort of not living up to their obligations under the NPT. That, I think, was the calculation. But it was a calculation that I think at the end of the day, Iran has lost. They have been forced to give huge concessions. The average Iranian citizen, of course, is forced to pay the price, and they have no say over the foreign policy of their own country, at least with respect to the nuclear program, which is why the conversation that we're having right now, Ian, cannot be had within the Islamic Republic of Iran. In fact, people who've tried to sort of raise these types of questions have been hauled before the Iranian judiciary, have been taken to jail. It's a red line, and the regime doesn't want a full public conversation or debate on this, because it's one that I don't think that the Iranian regime could actually... It's a debate that the Iranian regime could not win in the face of, a lot of critical skepticism from their own population. And people will just ask the average, the obvious question, is the price that we're paying, worth the cost of this nuclear program, the economic cost of the program? Is it worth the price? And so I think this is a colossal defeat, and I think most reasonable people can realize this, and those who can't, I think, have ideological biases that are warping their opinion and preventing them from seeing what is clearly a colossal collapse for Iran and its nuclear strategy.
Well, one of the other points that that William Beaman made in the conversation I had with him recently, where he was putting forth the idea that the Iranians took Obama to the cleaners and that they bluffed and they never intended to build a nuclear weapon, and that they weren't building a nuclear weapon, so they pulled off a real con. So I asked, it wasn't just Obama, it was the P5 plus one. So why would the Russians and the Chinese join with the Americans, the French, the British, and the Germans to force the Iranians into making this deal? And the answer was, well, the full story of that will be told later. Now, I don't know what the story is there, but one thing that does puzzle me is, why did Putin agree to the deal if it means that beginning next year, Iran will be able to start selling its oil, because it's got to bring itself up to speed? It's going to take a few months. But once the Iranian oil hits the world market, isn't that only going to contribute to an increasing glut on the global market, given that the Saudis are dumping oil?
Yeah.
And therefore lower the price of oil and then really impact Russia's economy? So that to me is a legitimate puzzlement.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, I think all of the P5 plus one countries, including Russia and including China, have an interest in limiting membership in the nuclear club of nations. They don't want Iran to develop the technological know-how and capacity to become a nuclear power. That's sort of built into an understanding of how international relations operates with respect to nuclear questions. And so I think that's really why they maintained more or less a united front with the United States and the European countries over this question. And, one has to just take a step back and sort of ask the obvious question. At the negotiating table in Vienna, you had Iran on one side, and then you had basically all of the major world powers on the other side of the table. What is the outcome of a negotiation where you have one sort of middle third world power at best, with a collapsing economy and a country that has its own internal legitimacy crisis on one side of the debate, and then you have the world powers on the other side? That's, it's pretty clear what the outcome of that type of negotiation will be. It's similar to the outcome of a clash or a conflict between an elephant and an ant. That's, I think, pretty clear to see. To say that somehow the ant won and was able to put one over on the elephant just doesn't make sense. Iran was the one that made the major concessions, and one has to simply listen to the debate within Tehran and among the hardliners, who are openly acknowledging that all the red lines that the Supreme Leader had laid down had been crossed.
So in terms of what you just said, Dada Hashemi, that the Chinese and the Russians were motivated largely because they don't want any more nations to join the nuclear club. Now, of course, China may well be regretting that it gave the nuclear weapons to Pakistan. That was back in the days of Mao Zedong. But I'm pretty sure that is the case. But in the case of the Russians, and perhaps this also applies to the Chinese, both the Russians and the Chinese are having problems with jihadists that are largely motivated by Saudi Arabian Wahhabism, Sunni Wahhabism. It's both in Chechnya and amongst the Uyghurs, and in China, or in Western China. So would their calculus then be that if Iran got a nuclear weapon — they're not necessarily suggesting that the Iranians are irrational — and dangerous, but as Netanyahu continues to claim, but that if Iran got a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia would almost immediately get one, probably buy one from Pakistan. So is that what people are worried about?
Yeah, I think that's connected to what I just said in response to your previous question. The concern about not wanting Iran to become a member of the nuclear club is really related to the whole concern about nuclear proliferation. So I suspect there is a linkage there that if Iran were to obtain the technology or the capacity to develop a nuclear weapon, then that would spur on Saudi Arabia, that would sort of embolden other regimes that are influenced by or where there are sections of their populations that are under the sway of these sort of neo-Wahhabi or Salafist thinkers. So I think that is part of the calculation. It very much overlaps with what I said before about the common concern that nuclear powers have from preventing other countries from proliferating weapons of mass destruction.
Well, but then you have to ask yourself, just to sort of pin down the logic here, if the Chinese share that concern with the Russians, we're assuming that they do, what's the Chinese situation vis-a-vis, does it apply then to the North Koreans? They already have a nuclear weapon. They're building as many as they can. The Chinese probably, they don't want South Korea and Japan to get nuclear weapons, and Japan apparently could turn to nuclear weapons very quickly.
That's right. I mean, Japan has a nuclear umbrella or an alliance effectively by the United States. If anything happens to Japan, the United States is there to protect it. So I think from that perspective, there's no incentive for the Japanese, even though we all know that they have the technology and the capacity to pursue a nuclear weapons program. And the same with South Korea. I think South Korea perceives itself as sort of under the sway of the American sort of strategic sort of vision for East Asia. With respect to North Korea and concerns that the Chinese have, I suspect there is probably another linkage here that China has sort of calculated the problems that North Korea's nuclear program has caused for security and stability in its own region, and it doesn't want to see this process or this problem, exported to other parts of the world. It becomes a hornet's nest. It leads to a lot of complicated problems for in this case China, and that's one reason beyond the reasons that I've already stated that has brought the Chinese on board with the P5+1 countries.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Happy to be with you. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book is The Syria Dilemma, and he has an article at CNN, Nuclear Deal Could Transform Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.